Now, Sandy.
Shirley, Huddy, Eddie, the sound of their entwined voices was oddly beautiful to me, like the voices of characters speaking lines in some strange play. Eddie said the crocodile had closed its mouth, and then his voice ceased, and I waited for one of the other voices to come in, and when none did, and Eddie himself didn't resume, I knew it was over. I knew, but Ned Wilcox didn't. Or maybe he did and just didn't want to admit it. Well, he said, and that barely disguised impatience was back in his voice. What happened when you dissected that bat thing? Tell me about the fish. Tell me everything. But this is important. Tell me a story. One that has a beginning and a middle and an end where everything is explained. Because I deserve that. Don't shake the rattle of your ambiguity in my face. I deny its place. I repudiate its claim. I want a story. He was young, and that explained part of it. He was faced with something that was, as they say, not of this earth. And that explained more of it. But there was something else, too. And it wasn't pretty. A kind of selfish, single-minded grubbing. And he thought he had a right. We spoil the grief-stricken. Have you ever noticed that? And they become used to the treatment. Well, what? I asked. I spoke in my least encouraging voice. Not that it would help. What happened when Sergeant Shane Dinks and my father got back? Did you catch Brian Lippy? Did he see? Did he tell? Jesus, you guys can't stop there. He was wrong. We could stop any place we chose to, but I kept that fact to myself, at least for the time being, and told him that, no, we never did catch Brian Lippy. Brian Lippy remained code Kubrick to this very day. Who wrote the report? Ned asked. Did you, Eddie? Or was it Trooper Morgan? George, he said with a trace of a grin. He was always better at stuff like that. Took creative writing in college. He used to say any state cop worth his salt needed to know the basics of creative writing. When we started to fall apart that day, George was the one who pulled us together. Didn't he, Huddy? Huddy nodded. Eddie got up, put his hands in the small of his back, and stretched until we could hear the bones crackle.
I gotta go home, fellas. Might stop for a beer at the tap on the way, maybe even two. After all this talking, I'm pretty dry, and soda pop just don't cut it.
Ned looked at him with surprise and anger and reproach.
You can't just leave like that, he exclaimed. I want to hear the whole thing.
And Eddie, who was slowly losing the struggle not to return to being Fat Eddie, said what I knew, what we all knew. He said it while looking at Ned with eyes which were not exactly friendly.
You did, kid. You just don't know it.
Ned watched him walk away, then turned to the rest of us. Only Shirley looked back with real sympathy, and I think that hers was tempered with sadness for the boy. What does he mean? I heard it all. There's nothing left but a few anecdotes, I said, and those are only variations on the same theme, about as interesting as the kernels at the bottom of a popcorn bowl. As for Brian Lippy, the report George wrote said Troopers Morgan and Jack Boy spoke to the subject and ascertained he was sober. Subject denied assaulting his girlfriend, and Trooper Jack Boy ascertained that the girlfriend supported him in this. Subject was then released. But Lippy kicked out their cruiser window.
Right, and under the circumstances, George and Eddie couldn't very well put in a claim for the damages.
So?
So, the money to replace it probably came out of the contingency fund. The Buick 8 contingency fund, if you want me to cross the T's. We keep it in the same place now we did then, a coffee can in the kitchen.
Yeah, that's where it come from, Arky said. Poor old coffee can's taken a fair number of hits over the years.
He stood up and also stretched his back.
Gotta go, boys and girls. Unlike some of you, I got friends. What they call a personal life on the daytime talk shows. But before I leave you, you want to know something else, Neddy? About that day? Anything you want to tell me?
They buried Dee. He said the verb the old way so it rhymes with scurried.
And right next to 'em, they buried the tools they use on that thing, poison 'em. One of them was my posthole digger, and I didn't get no coffee can compensation for that.
You didn't fill out a TS-1, that's why, Shirley said. I know the paperwork's a pain in the fanny, but... She shrugged as if to say,
that's the way of the world.
Archie was frowning suspiciously at her.
TS-1? What kind of form is that?
It's your tough shit list, Shirley told him, perfectly straight-faced. The one you fill out every month and send to the chaplain. Goodness, I never saw such a Swedish squarehead. Didn't they teach you anything in the army?
Archie flapped his hands at her, but he was smiling. He'd taken plenty of ribbing over the years, believe me. That accent of his attracted it.
Get out with you.
Walked right into it, Archie, I said.
I was also smiling. Ned wasn't. Ned looked as if the joking and teasing, our way of winding things back down to normal, had gone right past him. Where were you, Archie? He asked. Where were you when all this was going on?
Across from us, Eddie Jackaboy started his pickup truck and the headlights came on.
Vacation, Archie said, on my brother's farm in Wisconsin, so that was one mess someone else got to clean up.
He said this last with great satisfaction. Eddie drove past, giving us a wave. We gave him a little right back at you, Ned along with the rest of us, but he continued to look troubled.
I gotta get in gear too, Phil said.
He disposed of his cigarette butt, got on his feet, hitched up his belt.
Kiddo, leave it at this.
Your dad was an excellent officer and a credit to Troop D Statler Barracks. But I want to know.
It don't matter what you want to know, Phil told him gently.
He's dead, you're not. Those are the facts, as Joe Friday used to say. Good night, Sarge.
Night, I said, and watched the two of them, Archie and Phil, walk away together across the parking lot. There was good moonlight by then, enough for me to see that neither man so much as turned his head in the direction of Shed B. That left Huddy, Shirley, and me, plus the boy, of course, Curtis Wilcox's boy, who had come and mowed the grass and raked the leaves and erased the snowdrifts when it was too cold for Archie to be outside. Kurt's boy, who had quit off the football team and come here instead to try and keep his father alive a little longer. I remembered him holding up his college acceptance letter like a judge holding up a score at the Olympics, and I was ashamed to feel angry with him, considering all that he'd been through and how much he'd lost. But he wasn't the only boy in the history of the world to lose his dad, and at least there'd been a funeral, and his father's name was on the marble memorial out front of the barracks, along with those of Corporal Brady Paul, Trooper Albert Rizzo, and Trooper Samuel Stampson, who died in the 70s and is sometimes known in the PSP as the Shotgun Trooper. Until Stampson's death, we carried our shotguns in roof racks. If you needed the gun, you just had to reach up over your shoulder and grab it. Trooper Stampson was rear-ended while parked in the turnpike breakdown lane riding up a traffic stop. The guy who hit him was drunk and doing about 105 at the moment of impact. The cruiser accordioned forward. The gas tank didn't blow, but Trooper Stampson was decapitated by his own shotgun rack. Since 1974, we keep our shotguns clipped under the dash, and since 1973, Sam Stampson's name has been on the memorial. On the rock, we say. Ennis Rafferty is on the books as a disappearance, so he's not on the rock. The official story on Trooper George Morgan is that he died while cleaning his gun, the same Ruger that ended Mr. Dillon's misery. And since he didn't die on the job, his name isn't on the rock either. You don't get on the rock for dying as a result of the job. It was Tony Shane Dinks who pointed that out to me one day when he saw me looking at the names.
Probably just as well, he said. We'd have a dozen of those things out here.
Currently, the last name on the stone is Curtis K. Wilcox, July 2001, line of duty. It wasn't nice to have your father's name carved in granite when what you wanted, needed, was the father, but it was something. Ennis's name should have been carved there, too, so his bitch of a sister could come and look at it if she wanted to, but it wasn't. And what did she have? A reputation as a nasty old lady, that's what.
The kind of person who, if she saw you on fire in the street, wouldn't piss on you to put you out. She'd been a thorn in our side for years, and liking her was impossible, but feeling sorry for her was not. She'd ended up with even less than this boy, who at least knew for sure that his father was over, that he was never going to come back in someday with a shamefaced grin and some wild story to explain his empty pockets and how come he had that Tijuana tan and why it hurt like hell each time he had to pass a little water. I had no good feelings about the night's work. I'd hoped the truth might make things better. "It'll set you free," someone said, probably a fool. But I had an idea that it had made things worse instead. Satisfaction might have brought the curious cat back, but I could make out zero satisfaction on Ned Wilcox's face. All I saw there was a kind of stubborn, tired curiosity. I'd seen the same look on Curtis's face from time to time, most often when he was standing at one of Shed B's roll-up doors in that sidewalk superintendent's stance, legs apart, forehead to the glass, eyes squinted a little, mouth thoughtful. But what's passed down in the blood is the strongest chain of all, isn't it? What's mailed along, one generation to the next, good news here, bad news there, complete disaster over yonder. I said, as far as anyone knows, Brian Lippy just took off for greener pastures. Might even be the truth. None of us can say different for certain. And it's an ill wind that doesn't blow somebody some good. Him disappearing that way might have saved his girlfriend's life.
I doubt it, Huddy rumbled. I bet her next one was just Brian Lippy with different colored hair.
They pick up guys who beat them until they go through the change. It's like they define themselves through the bruises on their faces and arms.
She never filed a missing persons on him, tell you that, Shirley said. Not one that came across my desk anyway, and I see the town and county reports as well as our own. No one in his family did either. I don't know what happened to her, but he was an authentic case of good riddance to bad rubbish.
You don't believe he just slipped out through that broken window and ran away, do you? Ned asked Huddy. I mean, you were there.
No, Huddy said. As a matter of fact, I don't. But what I think doesn't matter.
The point's the same as the one Sarge has been trying to drum into your thick head all night long. We don't know.
It was as if the kid didn't hear him. He turned back to me.
What about my dad, Sandy? When it came to Brian Lippy, what did he believe?
He and Tony believed that Brian wound up in the same place as Ennis Rafferty and Jimmy the Gerbil. As for the corpse of the thing that they killed that day,
son of a bitch rotted quick, Shirley said in a brisk, that ends it voice.
There are pictures, and you can look at them all you want, but for the most part they're photos of something that could be anything, including a complete hoax. They don't show you how it looked when it was trying to get away from Mr. D., how fast it moved, or how loud it shrieked. They don't show you anything, really. Nor can we tell you so you'll understand. That's all over your face.
Do you know why the past is past, darling?
Ned shook his head.
Because it doesn't work.
She looked into her pack of cigarettes, and whatever she saw there must have satisfied her because she nodded, put them into her purse, and stood up.
I'm going home. I have two cats that should have been fed 3 hours ago.
That was Shirley, all right. Shirley, the all-American girlie, Kurt used to call her when he felt like getting under her skin a bit. No husband. There'd been one once when she was barely out of high school. No kids, two cats, roughly 10,000 beanie babies. Like me, she was married to Troop D. A walking cliché, in other words. And if you didn't like it, you could stick it.
Cheryl?
She turned to the plaintive sound in Ned's voice.
What, hon?
Did you like my father? She put her hands on his shoulders, bent down, and planted a kiss on Ned's forehead.
Loved him, kid.
And I love you. We've told you all we can, and it wasn't easy. I hope it helps. She paused. I hope it's enough.
I hope so, too, he said.
Shirley tightened her grip on his shoulders for a moment, giving him a squeeze. Then she let go and stood up. Hudson Royer, would you see a lady to her car?
My pleasure, he said and took her arm.
See you tomorrow, Sandy. You still on days?
Bright and early, I said. We'll do it all again.
You better go home and get some sleep, then.
I will.
He and Shirley left. Ned and I sat on the bench and watched them go. We raised our hands as they drove past in their cars. Huddy's big old New Yorker, Shirley in her little Subaru with a bumper sticker reading, "My karma ran over my dogma." When their taillights had disappeared around the corner of the barracks, I took out my cigarettes and had my own peek into the pack. One left. I'd smoke it and then quit. I'd been telling myself this charming fable for at least 10 years.
"There's really no more you can tell me?" Ned asked in a small, disillusioned voice.
"Nope. It'd never make a play, would it? There's no third act.
Tony and your dad ran a few more experiments over the next 5 years and finally brought B.B. Roth in on it. That would have been your father persuading Tony and me getting caught in the middle, as usual. And I have to tell you the truth. After Brian Lippy disappeared and Mr. Dillon died, I was against doing anything with the Buick beyond keeping an eye on it and offering up the occasional prayer that it would either fall apart or disappear back to where it came from. Oh, and killing anything that came out of the trunk still lively enough to stand up and maybe run around the shed looking for a way out.
Did that ever happen?
You mean another pink-headed E.T.?
No. And B.B., what did he say?
He listened to Tony and your dad. He took another look, and then he walked away. He said he was too old to deal with anything so far outside his understanding of the world and how it works. He told them he intended to erase the Buick from his memory and urged Tony and Kurt to do the same.
Oh, for God's sake, this guy was a scientist? Jesus, he should have been fascinated.
Your father was the scientist, I said. An amateur one, yeah, but a good one. The things that came out of the Buick and his curiosity about the Buick itself, those were the things that made him a scientist. His dissection of the bat thing, for instance. Crazy as that was, there was something noble about it, too. Like the Wright brothers going up in their little glue-and-paste airplane. B.B. Roth, on the other hand, B.B. was a microscope mechanic. He sometimes called himself that, and with absolute pride. He was a person who had carefully and consciously narrowed his vision to a single strip of knowledge, casting a blaze of light over a small area. Mechanics hate mysteries. Scientists, especially amateur scientists, embrace them. Your father was two people at the same time. As a cop, he was a mystery hater. As a roadmaster scholar, well, let's just say that when your father was that person, he was very different.
Which version did you like better?
I thought it over. Well, that's like a kid asking his parents who they love best, him or his sister. Not a fair question. But the amateur Kurt used to scare me.
Used to scare Tony a little, too.
The kid sat pondering this. A few more things appeared, I said. In 1991, there was a bird with four wings.
Four?
That's right. It flew a little bit, hit one of the walls, and dropped dead. In the fall of 1993, the trunk popped open after one of those light quakes, and it was half filled with dirt. Kurt wanted to leave it there and see what would happen, and Tony agreed at first, but then it began to stink. I didn't know dirt could decompose, but I guess it can if it's dirt from the right place, and so this is crazy. But we buried the dirt. Can you believe it? He nodded.
And did my dad keep an eye on the place where it was buried?
Sure he did, just to see what would grow. I think he was hoping for a few of those weird lilies.
Any luck?
I guess that depends on what you think of as luck. Nothing sprouted, I'll tell you that much. The dirt from the trunk went into the ground, not far from where we buried Mr. D and the tools. As for the monster, what didn't turn to goo, he burned in the incinerator. The ground where the dirt went is still bare. A few things try to straggle up every spring, but so far they always die. Eventually, I suppose that'll change.
I put the last cigarette in my mouth and lit it. A year and a half or so after the dirt delivery, we got another red stick lizard, dead. That's been the last. It's still earthquake country in there, but the earth never shakes as hard these days. It wouldn't do to be careless around the Buick any more than it would to be careless around an old rifle just because it's rusty and the barrel's plugged with dirt. But with reasonable precautions, it's probably safe enough. And someday, your dad believed it, Tony believed it, and I do too, that old car really will fall apart. All at once. Just like the wonderful one-horse shay in the poem. He looked at me vaguely, and I realized he had no idea what poem I was talking about. We live in degenerate times. Then he said, "I can feel it." Something in his tone startled me badly, and I gave him a hard stare. He still looked younger than his 18 years, I thought. Just a boy, no more than that, sitting with his sneakered feet crossed and his face painted with starlight. "Can you?" I asked. "Yes. Can't you?" All the troopers who'd passed through D over the years had felt the pull of it, I guessed. Felt it the way people who live on the coast come to feel the motions of the sea, the tides, a clock their hearts beat to. On most days and nights, we noticed it no more than you consciously notice your nose, a shape sitting at the bottom of all you see. Sometimes, though, the pull was stronger, and then it made you ache somehow. "All right," I said, "let's say I do." Huddy sure did. What do you think would have happened to him that day if Shirley hadn't screamed when she did? What do you think would have happened to him if he crawled into the trunk like he said he had a mind to do? "You really never heard that story before tonight, Sandy?" I shook my head. "You didn't look all that surprised, even so." "Nothing about that Buick surprises me anymore." "Do you think he really meant to do it? To crawl in and shut the lid behind him?" "Yes, only I don't think he had anything to do with it. It's that pull, that attraction it has. It was stronger then, but it's still there." He made no reply to that, just sat looking across at Shed B. "You didn't answer my question, Ned. What do you think would have happened to him if he'd crawled in there?" "I don't know." "A reasonable enough answer, I suppose. A kid's answer, certainly. They say it a dozen times a day. But I hated it just the same. He'd quit off the football team, but it seemed he hadn't forgotten all he'd learned there about bobbing and weaving." I drew in smoke that tasted like hot hay, then blew it back out. "You don't?" "No. After Ennis and Jimmy and probably Brian Lippi, you don't? Not everything goes on to somewhere else, Sandy. Take the other gerbil, for instance, Rosalie or Rosalind or whatever her name was." I sighed. "Have it your way. I'm going down to the country way to bite a cheeseburger. You're welcome to join me, but only if we can let this go and talk about something else." He thought it over, then shook his head. "I think I'll head home. Do some thinking." "Okay, but don't be sharing any of your thinking with your mother." He looked almost comically shocked. "God, no." I laughed and clapped him on the shoulder. The shadows had gone out of his face, and suddenly it was possible to like him again. As for his questions and his childish insistence that the story must have an ending and the ending must hold some kind of answer, time might take care of it. Maybe I'd been expecting too many of my own answers. The imitation lives we see on TV and in the movies whisper the idea that human existence consists of revelations and abrupt changes of heart. By the time we've reached full adulthood, I think this is an idea we have on some level come to accept. Such things may happen from time to time, but I think that for the most part it's a lie. Life's changes come slowly. They come the way my youngest nephew breathes in his deepest sleep. Sometimes I feel the urge to put a hand on his chest just to assure myself he's still alive. Seen in that light, the whole idea of curious cats attaining satisfaction seemed slightly absurd. The world rarely finishes its conversations. If 23 years of living with the Buick 8 had taught me nothing else, it should have taught me that. At this moment, Kurt's boy looked as if he might have taken a step toward getting better. Maybe even two. And if I couldn't let that be enough for one night, I had my own problems.
"You're in tomorrow, right?" I asked.
"Bright and early, Sarge. We'll do it all again."
"Then maybe you ought to postpone your thinking and do a little sleeping instead."
"I guess I can give it a try." He touched my hand briefly. "Thanks, Sandy."
"No problem."
"If I was a pisshead about any of it..."
"You weren't," I said. He had been a pisshead about some of it, but I didn't think he'd been able to help it. And at his age, I likely would have been pissier by far. I watched him walk toward the restored Bel Air his father had left behind, a car of roughly the same vintage as the one in our shed, but a good deal less lively. Halfway across the parking lot, he paused, looking at Shed B, and I paused with the smoldering stub of my cigarette poised before my lips, watching to see what he'd do. He moved on instead of going over. Good. I took a final puff on my delightful tube of death, thought about crushing it on the hot top, and found a place for it in the butt can instead, where roughly 200 previous butts had been buried standing up. The others could crush out their smokes on the pavement if they wanted to. Arky would sweep them up without complaint. But it was better if I didn't do that. I was the Sarge, after all, the guy who sat in the big chair. I went into the barracks. Stephanie Colucci was in dispatch, drinking a Coke and reading a magazine. She put the Coke down and smoothed her skirt over her knees when she saw me.
"What's up, sweetheart?" I asked.
"Nothing much. Communications are clearing up, though not as fast as they usually do after one of those. I've got enough to keep track of things."
"What things?"
"Nine is responding to a car fire on the I-87 exit 9 ramp. Max says the driver's a salesman headed for Cleveland, lit up like a neon sign and refusing a field sobriety test. 16 with a possible break-in at Statler Ford. Jeff Cutler with vandalism over at Statler Middle School, but he's just assisting. The local police have got that one."
"That it?"
"Paul Loving is 1098 for home in his cruiser. His son's having an asthma attack."
"You might forget to put that on the report."
Steffi gave me a reproachful look, as if she hardly needed me to tell her that. "What's going on in Shed B?"
"Nothing," I said. "Well, nothing much. Normalizing. I'm out of here. If anything comes up, just..." I stopped, sort of horrified.
"Sandy," she asked, "is something wrong?"
"If anything comes up, call Tony Shane Dinks," I'd been about to say, as if 20 years hadn't slipped under the bridge and the old Sarge wasn't dribbling mindlessly in front of Nick at night in a Statler nursing home. "Nothing's wrong," I said. "If anything comes up, call Frank Soderberg. It's his turn in the barrel."
"Very good, sir. Have a nice night."
"Thanks, Steph. Right back at you."
As I stepped out, the Bel Air rolled slowly toward the driveway with one of those groups Ned likes, Wilco, or maybe the Jayhawks, blaring from the custom speakers. I lifted a hand and he returned the wave with a smile, a sweet one. Once more, I found it hard to believe I'd been so angry with him. I stepped over to the shed and assumed the position, that feet-apart sidewalk superintendent stance that makes everyone feel like a Republican somehow, ready to heap contempt on welfare slackers at home and flag-burning foreigners abroad. I looked in. There it sat, silent under the overhead lights, casting a shadow just as though it were sane, fat, and luxy on its white wall tires. A steering wheel that was far too big, a hide that rejected dirt and healed scratches. That happened more slowly now, but it did still happen. "Oil's fine," was what the man said before he went around the corner. Those were his last words on the matter. And here it still was, like an object d'art somehow left behind in a closed-down gallery. My arms broke out in goose flesh, and I could feel my balls tightening. My mouth had that dry lint taste it gets when I know I'm in deep shit.
Half past trouble and going on jackpot, Ennis Rafferty used to say. It wasn't humming and it wasn't glowing. The temperature was up above 60 again, but I could feel it pulling at me, whispering for me to come in and look. It could show me things, it whispered, especially now that we were alone. Looking at it like this made one thing clear. I'd been angry at Ned because I'd been scared for him. Of course. Looking at it like this, feeling its tidal pull way down in the middle of my head, beating in my guts and my groin as well, made everything easier to understand. The Buick bred monsters, yes, but sometimes you still wanted to go to it. The way you sometimes wanted to look over the edge when you're on a high place or peer into the muzzle of your gun and see the hole at the end of the barrel turn into an eye. One that was watching you. Just you and only you. There was no sense trying to reason your way through such moments or trying to understand that neurotic attraction. Best to just step back from the drop, put the gun back in its holster, drive away from the barracks, away from Shed B. Until you got beyond the range of that subtle, whispering voice. Sometimes running away is a perfectly acceptable response. I stood there a moment longer, though, feeling that distant beat, beat, beat in my head and around my heart, looking in at that midnight blue Buick Roadmaster. And then I stepped back, drew a deep breath of night air, and looked up at the moon until I felt entirely myself again. When I did, I went to my own car and got in and drove away. The country way wasn't crowded. It never is these days, not even on Friday and Saturday nights. The restaurants out by Walmart and the new Statler Mall are killing the downtown eateries just as surely as the new Cineplex out on 32 killed off the old Gem Theater downtown. As always, people glanced at me when I walked in. Only it's the uniform they're really looking at, of course. A couple of guys, one a deputy sheriff, the other a county attorney, said hello and shook my hand. The attorney asked if I wouldn't join him and his wife, and I said no thanks, I might be meeting someone. The idea of being with people, of having to do any more talking that night, even small talking, made me feel sick in my stomach. I sat in one of those little booths in the back of the main room, and Cynthia Garris came over to take my order. She was a pretty blonde thing with big, beautiful eyes. I'd noticed her making someone a sundae when I came in, and was touched to see that between delivering the ice cream and bringing me a menu, she'd undone the top button of her uniform so that the little silver heart she wore at the base of her throat showed. I didn't know if that was for me or just another response to the uniform. I hoped it was for me. Hey, Sandy, where you been lately? Olive Garden? Outback? Macaroni Grill? One of those? She sniffed with mock disdain. Nope, just been eating in. What you got on special? Chicken and gravy. Stuffed shells with meat sauce. Both of them a little heavy on a night like this, in my humble opinion. And fried haddock. All you can eat's a dollar more. You know the deal. Think I'll just have a cheeseburger and an Iron City to wash it down with. She jotted on her pad, then gave me a real stare.
Are you all right? You look tired.
I am tired. Otherwise, fine. Seen anyone from Troop D tonight?
George Stankowski was in earlier. Otherwise, you're it, darling. Cop-wise, I mean. Well, those guys out there, but...
She shrugged as if to say those guys weren't real cops. As it happened, I agreed with her. Well, if the robbers come in, I'll stop them single-handed.
If they tip 15%, hero, let them rob, she said. I'll get your beer.
Off she went, pert little tail switching under white nylon.
Pete Quinlan, the Grease Pit's original owner, was long gone, but the mini jukeboxes he installed were still on the walls of the booths. The selections were in a kind of display book, and there were little chrome levers on top to turn the pages. These antique gadgets no longer worked, but it was hard to resist twiddling the levers, turning the pages, and reading the songs on the little pink labels. About half of them were by Pete's beloved chairman of the board,
Hepcat fingersnappers like witchcraft and luck be a lady tonight. Frank Sinatra, said the little pink labels, and beneath, in smaller letters, the Nelson Riddle Orchestra. The others were those old rock and roll songs you never think about anymore once they leave the charts, the ones they never seem to play on the oldies stations, although you'd think there'd be room. After all, how many times can you listen to Brandy, You're a Fine Girl before beginning to scream? I flipped through the jukebox pages, looking at tunes a dropped quarter would no longer call forth. Time marches on. If you're quiet, you can hear its shuffling, rueful tread.
If anyone asks about the Buick 8, just tell them it's an impound.
That's what the old Sarge had said on the night we met out here in the back room. By then the waitresses had been sent away and we were pulling our own beers, running our own tab, keeping our account straight down to the very last penny.
Honor system. And why not?
We were honorable men, doing our duty as we saw it. Still are.
We're the Pennsylvania State Police, you see.
The real road warriors.
As Eddie used to say when he was younger as well as thinner, it's not just a job, it's a fucking adventure.
I turned a page. It was Heart of Glass by Blondie. On this subject, you can't get far enough off the record. More words of wisdom from Tony Shaindinks, spoken while the blue clouds of cigarette smoke rose to the ceiling. Back then, everybody smoked, except maybe for Kurt, and look what happened to him. Sinatra sang One for My Baby from the overhead speakers, and from the steam tables had come the sweet smell of barbecued pork. The old Sarge had been a believer in that off-the-record stuff, at least as regarded the Buick, until his mind had taken French leave, first just infantry squads of brain cells stealing away in the night, then platoons, then whole regiments in broad daylight. "What's not on the record can't hurt you," he told me once. This was around the time when it became clear it would be me who'd step into Tony's shoes and sit in Tony's office. "Ooh, Grandpa, what a big chair you have." Only I'd gone on the record tonight, hadn't I? Yeah, whole hog. Opened my mouth and spilled the whole tale. With a little help from my friends, as the song says. We'd spilled it to a boy who was still lost in the funhouse of grief, who was agog with quite natural curiosity in spite of that grief. A lost boy, perhaps. On TV, such tales as Ned's end happily. But I can tell you that life in Statler, Pennsylvania bears christing little resemblance to the Hallmark Hall of Fame. I told myself I knew the risks, but now I found myself wondering if that was really true. Because we never go forward believing we will fail, do we? No. We do it because we think we're going to save the goddamn day, and 6 times out of 10 we step on the business end of a rake hidden in the high grass, and up comes the handle and whammo right between the eyes.
Tell me what happened when you dissected the bat. Tell me about the fish.
Here was Pledging My Love by Johnny Ace. Brushing aside every effort I made, that any of us made, to suggest this lesson was not in the learning, but in the letting go. Just bullying onward. Sort of a surprise he hadn't read us the Miranda, because hadn't it been an interrogation as much as it had been stories of the old days when his old man had still been alive? Young and alive. I still felt sick in my stomach. I could drink the beer Cynthia was bringing, the bubbles might even help, but eat a cheeseburger. I didn't think so. It had been years since the night Curtis dissected the bat thing, but I was thinking about it now. How he'd said, "Inquiring minds want to know," and then poked his scalpel into its eye. The eye had made a popping sound and then collapsed, dribbling out of its socket like a black tear. Tony and I had screamed, and how was I supposed to eat a cheeseburger now, remembering that? "Stop it. This is pointless," I'd said. But he hadn't stopped. The father had been as insistent as the son. "Let's look in the lower gut and then we're done," he had said. Only he had never been done. He had poked, he had prodded,
he had investigated, and the Buick had killed him for his pains. I wondered if the boy knew it. I wondered if he understood the Buick Roadmaster 8 had killed his father as surely as Huddy, George, Eddie, Shirley, and Mr. Dillon had killed the shrieking monstrosity that had come out of the car's trunk in 1988. Here was Billy Don't Be a Hero by Bo Donaldson in the Haywoods, gone from the charts and our hearts. Tell me about the bat. Tell me about the fish. Tell me about the E.T. with the pink cords for hair. The thing that could think. The thing that showed up with something like a radio. Tell me about my father, too, because I have to come to terms with him. Of course I do. I see his life in my face and his ghost in my eyes every time I stand at the mirror to shave. Tell me everything. But don't tell me there's no answer. Don't you dare. I reject that. I repudiate it. Oil's fine, I murmured, and turned the steel levers on top of the booth's mini-juke a little faster. There was sweat on my forehead. My stomach felt worse than ever. I wished I could believe it was the flu, or maybe food poisoning, but it wasn't either one, and I knew it. Oil's just fucking ducky. Here was Indiana Wants Me, and Green-Eyed Lady, and Love is Blue. Songs that had somehow slipped between the cracks. Surfer Joe by the Safaris. Tell me everything. Tell me the answers. Tell me the one answer. The kid had been clear about the things he wanted. You had to give him that. He'd asked for it with the pure, untinctured selfishness of the lost and the grief-stricken. Except once. He'd started to ask for one piece of the past, and then changed his mind. What piece had that been? I reached for it, fumbled at it, felt it shrink slyly from my touch. When that happens, it's no good to chase. You have to back off and let the recollection come back to you of its own free will. I thumbed the pages of the useless jukebox back and forth, little pink stickers like tongues. Poke Salad Annie by Tony Joe White and Tell Me About the Year of the Fish. When, by the Kalin Twins, and Tell Me About the Meeting You Had. Tell me everything. Tell me everything but the one thing that might pop up a red flag in your suspicious cop's mind. Here's your beer, Cynthia Garris began, and then there was a light gasp. I looked up from twiddling the metal levers. The pages flipping back and forth under the glass had half hypnotized me by then. She was looking at me with fascinated horror. Sandy, you got a fever, hon? Because you're just running with sweat. And that was when it came to me, telling him about the Labor Day picnic of 1979. The more we talked, the more we drank, Phil Candleton had said. My head ached for 2 days after. Sandy? Cynthia standing there with a bottle of IC in a glass. Cynthia, with the top button of her uniform undone so she could show me her heart, so to speak. She was there, but she wasn't. She was years from where I was at that moment. All that talk and not one single conclusion, I'd said, and the talk had moved on, to the O'Day farm, among other things. And then all at once the boy had asked, had begun to ask, Sandy, that day at the picnic, did any of you talk about... And then he had trailed off. Did any of you talk about destroying it? I said. That's the question he didn't finish. I looked into Cynthia Garris's frightened, concerned face. He started to ask, and then he stopped. Had I thought story time was over and Kurt's boy was heading home? That he'd let go that easily? A mile or so down the road, headlights had passed me going the other way, going back toward the barracks at a good but not quite illegal clip. Had Kurt Wilcox's Bel Air been behind those lights, and Kurt Wilcox's son behind the wheel? Had he gone back just as soon as he could be sure we were gone? I thought yes. I took the bottle of Iron City from Cynthia's tray, watching my arm stretch out and my hand grasp the neck the way you watch yourself do things in dreams. I felt the cold ring of the bottle's neck slip between my teeth and
thought of George Morgan in his garage, sitting on the floor and smelling cut grass under the mower. That good green smell. I drank the beer, all of it. Then I stood up and put a 10 on Cynthia's tray. Sandy? I can't stay and eat, I said. I forgot something back at the barracks. I kept a battery-powered Kojak light in the glove compartment of my personal and put it on the roof as soon as I was out of town, running my car up to 80 and trusting to the red flasher to get anyone ahead of me out of my way. There weren't many. Western Pennsylvania folks roll up the sidewalks early on most weeknights. It was only 4 miles back to the barracks, but the run seemed to take an hour. I kept thinking about how my heart sank each time Ennis's sister, the dragon, walked into the barracks under the haystack heap of her outrageous henna hair. I kept thinking, get out of here, you're too close. And I didn't even like her. How much worse would it be to have to face Michelle Wilcox, especially if she had the twins, the little Jays, with her? I drove up the driveway too fast, just as Eddie and George had done a dozen or so years before, wanting to be rid of their unpleasant prisoners so they could go over to Poteenville, where it must have seemed half the world was going up in smoke. The names of old songs. I Met Him on a Sunday, Ballroom Blitz, Sugar, Sugar, jigged senselessly up and down my head. Foolish, but better than asking myself what I'd do if the Bel Air was back, but empty. What I'd do if Ned Wilcox was gone off the face of the earth. The Bel Air was back, as I'd known it would be. He'd parked it where Arky's truck had been earlier, and it was empty. I could see that in the first splash of my headlights. The song titles dropped out of my head. What replaced them was a cold readiness, the kind that comes by itself empty-handed and without plans, ready to improvise. The Buick had taken hold of Kurt's boy. Even while we'd been sitting with him, conducting our own peculiar kind of wake for his dad and trying to be his friend, it had reached out and taken hold of him. If there was still a chance to take him back, I'd do well not to bitch it up by thinking too much. Steph, probably worried at the sight of a single Kojak instead of a rack of roof lights, poked her head out of the back door. "Who's that? Who's there?" "It's me, Steph." I got out of the car, leaving it parked where it was, with the red bubble flashing on the roof over the driver's seat. If anyone came hauling in behind me, it would at least keep them from rear-ending my car. "Go back inside."
"What's wrong?"
"Nothing."
"That's what he said."
She pointed at the Bel Air and then stalked back inside. I ran for the roll-up door of Shed B and the stutter pulse of the light. So many stressful moments of my life have been lit by flashers. A John Q stopped or overtaken by flashers is always frightened. They have no idea what those same lights sometimes do to us and what we have seen by their glow. We always left a light on in the shed, but it was brighter than a single night light in there now. And the side door was standing open. I thought about diverting to it, then kept on as I was. I wanted a look at the playing field before anything else. What I'd been most afraid of seeing was nothing but the Buick. Looking in, I discovered something scarier. The boy was sitting behind the Roadmaster's oversized steering wheel with his chest smashed in. There was nothing where his shirt had been except a bright, bloody ruin. My legs started to unbuckle at the knees, and then I realized it wasn't blood I was looking at after all. Maybe not blood. The shape was too regular. There was a straight red line running just below the round neck of his blue T-shirt, and corners. Neat, right-angled corners. No, not blood. The gas can Arky kept for the mower. Ned shifted behind the wheel and one of his hands came into view. It moved slowly, dreamily. There was a Beretta in it. Had he been driving around with his father's sidearm in the trunk of the Bel Air, perhaps even in the glove compartment? I decided it didn't matter. He was sitting in that death trap with gas and a gun. Kill or cure, I'd thought. It had never crossed my mind to think he might try doing both at the same time. He didn't see me. He should have. My white, scared face filling one of those dark windows should have been perfectly visible to him where he sat. He should have seen the red pulse from the light I'd stuck on the roof of my car. He saw neither. He was as hypnotized as Huddy Royer had been when Huddy decided to crawl into the roadmaster's trunk and pull the lid shut behind him. I could feel it even from outside. That tidal pulse. That liveliness. There were even words in it. I suppose I might have made them up to suit myself, but it almost doesn't matter because it was the pulse that called them forth, the throb all of us had felt around the Buick from the very start. It was a throb some of us, the boy's father for one, had felt more strongly than others. "Come in or stay out," the voice in my head told me, and it spoke with perfect, chilling indifference. "I'll take one or two, then sleep. That much more mischief before I'm done for good. One or two. I don't care which." I looked up at the round thermometer mounted on the beam. The red needle had stood at 61 before I went down to the country way, but now it had dropped back to 57. I could almost see it slumping to even colder levels as I watched. And all at once I was struck by a memory, so vivid it was frightening. On the smoker's bench, this had been. I'd been smoking and Kurt had just been sitting. The smoker's bench had assumed odd importance in the 6 years since the barracks itself was declared a smoke-free zone. It's where we went to compare notes on cases we were rolling, to work out scheduling conflicts, to mull over retirement plans and insurance plans and the GDR. It was on the smoker's bench that Carl Brundage told me his wife was leaving him and taking the kids. His voice hadn't quavered, but tears had gone rolling down his cheeks as he talked. Tony had been sitting on the bench with me on one side and Kurt on the other. "Christ and the two thieves," he'd said with a sardonic smile, when he told us he was putting me up for the SC post his own retirement would leave vacant. If I wanted it, that was. The little gleam in his eyes saying he knew goddamn well I wanted it. Curtis and I had both nodded, not saying much. And it was on the smoker's bench that Kurt and I had our final discussion about the Buick 8. How soon before his death had that been? I realized with a nasty chill that it might have been on the very day. Certainly that would explain why the vividness of the memory seemed so terrible to me. "Does it think?" Kurt had asked. I could remember strong morning sun on his face and, I think, a paper cup of coffee in his hand. Does it watch and think? Wait for its chances? Pick its moments? "I'm almost sure not," I had replied. But I'd been troubled. Because almost covers a lot of territory, doesn't it? Maybe the only word in the language that covers more is if. But it saved its biggest horror show for a time when this place was almost entirely deserted, Ned's father had said. Thoughtful, setting his coffee aside so he could turn his Stetson over and over in his hands, an old habit of his. If I was right about the day, that hat was less than 5 hours from being knocked from his head and cast bloody into the weeds where it would later be found among the McDonald's wrappers and empty Coke cans. As if it knew. As if it can think. Watch. Wait. I had laughed. It was one of those gruff little ha-ha laughs that don't really have much amusement in them. I told him he was cuckoo on the subject. I said, "Next thing you'll be telling me it sent out a ray or something to make that Norco tanker crash into the school bus that day." He made no verbal reply, but his eyes had looked a question at me. "How do you know it didn't?" And then I had asked the boy's question. I had asked. A warning bell went off inside my head, very dim and deep. I stepped back from the window and raised my hands to my face as if I thought I could block off that tidal ache simply by blocking off sight of the Buick. And the sight of Ned looking so white and lost behind the oversized steering wheel. It had taken hold of him, and just now, briefly, it had taken hold of me. Had tried to sidetrack me with a lot of old useless memories. Whether or not it had consciously waited for its chance to get at Ned didn't matter. What mattered
was that the temperature in there was going down fast, almost diving, and if I intended doing something, now was the time.
Maybe you ought to get some backup in on this, the voice in my head whispered.
It sounded like my own voice, but it wasn't. Might be someone in the barracks. I'd check if I were you. Not that it matters to me. Doing one more piece of mischief before I sleep, that's what matters to me. Pretty much all that matters to me. And why? Because I can, Hoss. Just because I can.
Backup seemed like a good idea. God knows I was terrified at the idea of going into Shed B on my own and approaching the Buick in its current state. What got me going was the knowledge that I had caused this. I was the one who had opened Pandora's box. I ran around to the hutch, not pausing at the side door, although I registered the smell of gasoline, heavy and rich. I knew what he'd done. The only question was how much gas he'd poured under the car and how much he'd saved back in the can. The door to the hutch was secured with a padlock. For years it had been left open, the curved steel arm just poked through the hasp to keep the door from swinging open in a breeze. The lock was open that night, too. I swear that's the truth. It wasn't noontime bright out there, but there was enough glow from the open side door to see the lock clearly. Then, as I reached for it, the steel post slid down into the hole on the body of the lock with a tiny, audible click. I saw that happen, and I felt it, too. For just a moment, the pulse in my head sharpened and focused. It was like a gasp of effort. I keep two key rings, cop keys and personals. There were about 20 on the official ring, and I used a trick I'd learned a long time before from Tony Shaindinks. I let the keys fall on my palm as they would like pickup sticks, then simply felt among them without looking. It doesn't always work, but this time it did, likely because the key to the hutch padlock was smaller than all the others except the one to my locker downstairs, and the locker key has a square head. Now faintly I heard the humming begin. It was faint, like the sound of a motor buried in the earth, but it was there. I took the key my fingers had found and rammed it into the padlock. The steel arm popped up again. I yanked the lock out of the hasp and dropped it on the ground. Then I opened the door to the hutch and stepped inside. The little storage space held the still and explosive heat which belongs only to attics and sheds and cubbyholes that have been closed up for a long time in hot weather. No one came out here much anymore, but the things which had accumulated over the years, except for the paint and the paint thinner, flammable items that had been prudently removed, were still here. I could see them in the faint wash of light. Stacks of magazines, the kind men read, for the most part. Women think we like to look at naked women, but mostly I think we like tools. The kitchen chair with the tape-mended seat, the cheap police band radio from Radio Shack, the video cam, its battery undoubtedly dead, on its shelf next to the old box of blank tapes. A bumper sticker was pasted to one wall. Support the mentally handicapped, take an FBI agent to lunch. I could smell dust. In my head, the pulse that was the Buick's voice was getting stronger and stronger. There was a hanging light bulb and a switch on the wall, but I didn't even try it. I had an idea the bulb would be dead, or the switch would be live enough to give me a real walloper of a shock. The door swung shut behind me, cutting off the moonlight. That was impossible, because when it was left to its own devices, the door always swung the other way, outward. We all knew it. It was why we left the padlock threaded through the hasp. Tonight, however, the impossible was selling cheap. The force inhabiting the Buick wanted me in the dark. Maybe it thought being in the dark would slow me down. It didn't. I'd already seen what I needed. The coil of yellow rope still hanging on the wall below the joke sticker and next to a forgotten set of jumper cables. I saw something else, too. Something Kurt Wilcox had put up on the shelf near the video cam not long after the ET with the lashing pink ropes had made its appearance. I took this item, stuck it in my back pocket, and grabbed the coil of rope from the wall. Then I banged out again. A dark form loomed up in front of me, and I almost screamed.
For one mad moment, I was sure it was the man in the dark coat and hat, the one with the malformed ear and the Boris Badenov accent. When the boogeyman spoke up, however, the accent was pure Lawrence Welk.
"That damn kid came back," Arky whispered. "I got halfway home, and you, this priest, I just turned around, and I knew it. Somehow, I just..."
I interrupted then. I told him to stay clear and ran back around the corner of Shed B with the rope looped over my arm.
"Don't go in there, Sarge," Arky said.
I think he might have been trying to shout, but he was too scared to get much in the way of volume.
"He's thrown down gas, and he got a gun. I seen it."
I stopped beside the door, slipped the rope off my arm, started to tie one end to the stout hook mounted there, then gave the coil of rope to Arky instead.
"Sandy, can you feel it?" he asked. "And the radio going all bluey again, nothing but static. I heard Steph cussing at it through the window."
"Never mind. Tie the end of the rope off. Use the hook."
"Huh?"
"You heard me." I'd held onto the loop in the end of the rope, and now I stepped into it, yanked it up to my waist, and ran it tight. It was a hangman's knot, tied by Kurt himself, and it ran shut easily.
"Sarge, you can't do this!"
Arky made as if to grab my shoulder, but without any real force. "Tie it off, then hold on," I said. "Don't go in, no matter what. If we..." I wasn't going to say if we disappear, though. I didn't want to hear those words come out of my mouth. "If anything happens, tell Steph to put out a code D as soon as the static clears."
"Jesus!"
Only from Arky it sounded more like Jesus. "What, are you crazy? Can't you feel it?" "I feel it," I said, and went inside. I shook the rope continually as I went to keep it from snagging. I felt like a diver starting down to some untried depth, minding his air hose. Not because he really thinks minding it will help, but because it's at least something to do. Something to keep your mind off the things that may be swimming around in the blackness just beyond the reach of your light. The Buick 8 sat fat and luxy on its white walls, our little secret humming deep down in the hollows of itself. The pulse was stronger than the humming, and now that I was actually inside, I felt it stop its half-hearted efforts to keep me out. Instead of pushing with its invisible hand, it pulled. The boy sat behind the wheel with the gas can in his lap, his cheeks and forehead white, the skin there taut and shiny. As I came toward him, his head turned with robotic slowness on his neck, and he looked at me. His gaze was wide and dark. In it was the stupidly serene look of the deeply drugged or the cataclysmically wounded. The only emotion that remained in his eyes was a terrible, weary stubbornness, that adolescent insistence that there must be an answer, and he must know the answer. He had a right, and that was what the Buick had used, of course, what it had used against him.
"Ned?"
"I'd get out of here if I were you, Sarge," speaking in slow, perfectly articulated syllables. "There's not much time. It's coming. It sounds like footsteps." And he was right. I felt a sudden surge of horror. The hum was some sort of machinery, perhaps. The pulse was almost certainly a kind of telepathy. This was something else, though. A third thing. Something was coming.
"Ned, please. You can't understand what this thing is, and you certainly can't kill it. All you can do is get yourself sucked up like dirt in a vacuum cleaner. And that'll leave your mother and your sisters on their own. Is that what you want? To leave them alone with 1,000 questions no one can answer? It's hard for me to believe that a boy who came here looking so hard for his father could be so selfish."
Something flickered in his eyes at that. It was the way a man's eyes may flicker when, deep in concentration, he hears a loud noise on the next block. Then the eyes grew serene again.
"This goddamn car killed my dad," he said, spoken calmly, even patiently.
I certainly wasn't going to argue with that.
"All right, maybe it did. Maybe in some way it was as much to blame for what happened to your dad as Bradley Roach was.
Does that mean it can kill you, too? What is this, Ned? Buy one, get one free?
I'm going to kill it, he said. And at last something rose in his eyes, disturbing the surface serenity. It was more than anger. To me, it looked like a kind of madness. He raised his hands. In one was the gun, in the other he now held a butane match. Before it sucks me through, I'm going to light its damn transporter on fire. That'll shut the door to this side forever. That's step one. Spoken with the scary, unconscious arrogance of youth, positive that this idea has occurred to no one before it has occurred to him.
And if I live through that experience, I'm going to kill whatever's waiting on the other side. That's step two.
Whatever's waiting. I realized the enormity of his assumptions and was staggered by them.
Ah, Ned! Oh, Christ!
The pulse was stronger now. So was the hum. I could feel the unnatural cold that marked the Buick's periods of activity settling against my skin, and saw a purple light first blooming in the air just above the oversized steering wheel, and then starting to skate across its surface. Coming. It was coming. 10 years ago, it would have been here already. Maybe even 5. Now it took a little longer.
Do you think there's going to be a welcoming party, Ned? Are you expecting them to send the exalted president of the yellow-skinned, pink-haired people, or maybe the emperor of the alternate universe to say howdy and give you the key to the city? Do you think they'd take the trouble? For what? A kid who can't accept the fact that his father is dead and get on with his own life? Shut up. Know what I think? I don't care what you think. I think the last thing you see is going to be a whole lot of nothing much before you choke to death on whatever they breathe over there.
The uncertainty flickered in his eyes again. Part of him wanted to do a George Morgan and just finish it. But there was another part of him as well, one that might not care so much about Pitt anymore but still wanted to go on living. And above both, above and under and around, binding everything was the pulse and the quietly calling voice. It wasn't even seductive. It just pulled at you.
Sarge, come out of there,
Markey called. I ignored him and kept my eyes on Kurt's boy.
Ned, use the brains that got you this far, please.
Not shouting at him, but raising my voice to get it over the strengthening hum, and at the same time I touched the thing I'd put in my back pocket.
This res you're sitting in may be alive, but that still doesn't make it worth your time. It's not much different from a Venus flytrap or a pitcher plant, don't you see that? You can't get revenge out of this thing, not even a nickel's worth. It's brainless.
His mouth began to tremble. That was a start, but I wished to God he'd let go of the gun or at least lower it. And there was the butane match. Not as dangerous as the automatic, but bad enough. My shoes were in gasoline as I stood near the driver's door of the Buick, and the fumes were strong enough to make my eyes water. Now the purple glow had begun to spin lazy lines of light across the bogus dashboard controls and to fill up the speedometer dial, making it look like the bubble in a carpenter's level.
"It killed my daddy!"
he shouted in a child's voice, but it wasn't me he was shouting at. He couldn't find whatever it was he wanted to shout at, and that was precisely what was killing him.
No, Ned, listen. If this thing could laugh, it'd be laughing now. It didn't get the father the way it wanted to, not the way it got Ennis and Brian Lippy, but now it's got a damn fine chance at the son. If Kurt knows, if he sees, he must be screaming in his grave. Everything he feared, everything he fought to prevent, all of it happening again to his own son. Stop it! Stop it!
Tears were spilling over his eyelids. I bent down, bringing my face into that growing purple glow, into the welling coldness. I brought my face down to Ned's face, where the resistance was finally crumbling. One more blow would do it. I pulled the can I'd taken from the hutch out of my back pocket and held it against my leg and said,
"He must be hearing it laugh, Ned. He must know it's too late. No! And that there's nothing he can do. Nothing at all.
He raised his hands to cover his ears, the gun in the left, the butane match in the right, the gas can balanced on his thighs, his legs dimming out to lavender mist below his shins, that glow rising like water in a well, and it wasn't great. I hadn't knocked him as completely off balance as I would have liked, but it would have to be good enough. I pushed the cap off the aerosol can with my thumb. Had just one fraction of a second to wonder if there was any pressure left in the damn thing after all the years it had stood unused on the shelf in the hutch. And then I maced him. Ned howled with surprise and pain as the spray hit his eyes and nose. His finger squeezed the trigger of his dad's Beretta. The report was deafening in the shed. "God damn!" I heard Arky shout through the ringing in my ears. I grabbed the door handle, and as I did, the little locking post went down by itself, just like the arm of the padlock on the hutch door. I reached through the open window, made a fist, and punched the side of the gas can. It flew off the convulsing boy's lap, tumbled into the misty lavender light rising up from the floor of the car, and disappeared. I had a momentary sense of it tumbling, the way things do when you drop them off a high place. The gun went off again, and I felt the wind of the slug. It wasn't really close. He was still firing blind into the Buick's roof, probably unaware that he was shooting at all. But whenever you can feel the air stir with a bullet's passage, it's too damn close. I fumbled down inside the Buick's door, finally found the inside handle and pulled. If it didn't come up, I wasn't sure what I'd do next. He was too big and heavy to yank through the window. But it did come up, and the door opened. As it did, a brilliant purple flash rose up from where the roadmaster's floorboards had been. The trunk banged open, and the real pulling began. Sucked up like dirt in a vacuum cleaner, I'd said, but I hadn't known the half of it. That tidal beat suddenly sped up to a ferocious, arrhythmic pounding, like precursor waves before the tsunami that will destroy everything. There was a sense of an inside-out wind that seemed to pull instead of push, that wanted to suck your eyeballs from their sockets and then peel the skin right off your face, and yet not a hair on my head stirred. Ned screamed. His hands dropped suddenly, as if invisible ropes had been tied around his wrists, and now someone below him was yanking on them. He started to sink in his seat. Only the seat was no longer precisely there. It was vanishing, dissolving into that stormy bubble of rising violet light. I grabbed him under the arms, yanked, stumbled backward first one step, then two, fighting the incredible traction of the force, trying to pull me into the descending purple throat that had been the Buick's interior. I fell over backward with Ned on top of me, gasoline soaked through the legs of my pants. "Pull us!" I screamed at Arky. I paddled with my feet, trying to slide away from the Buick and the light pouring out of it. My feet could find no good purchase. They kept slipping in the gasoline. Ned was yanked, pulled toward the open driver's door so hard he was almost torn out of my grip. At the same time, I felt the rope tighten around my waist. We were tugged sharply backward as I resettled my grip around Ned's chest. He was still holding the gun, but as I watched, his arm shot out straight in front of him and the gun flew from his hand. The throbbing purple light in the cabin of the car swallowed it up, and I thought I heard it fire twice more, all by itself, as it disappeared. At the same time, the pull around us seemed to weaken a little, maybe enough to make our escape if we went now, just exited stage left with no hesitation.
"Pull!"
I screamed at Arky.
"Boss, I'm pulling as hard as... Pull harder!"
There was another furious yank, one that cut my breath off as Curtis's hangman's noose pulled tight around my midsection. Then I was scrambling to my feet and stumbling backward at the same time, with the boy still clasped in front of me. He was gasping, his eyes puffed shut like the eyes of a fighter who's had the worst of it for 12 rounds. I don't think he saw what happened next. The inside of the Buick was gone, cored out by purple light. Some unspeakable, unknowable conduit had opened. I was looking down an infected gullet and into another world. I might have frozen in place long enough for the suction to renew its hold on me and pull me in, to pull both of us in. But then Arky was screaming high and shrill.
Help me, Steph! God's sake, Michael on here and help me!
She must have done it, too, because a second or so later, Ned and I were yanked backward like a couple of well-hooked fish. I went down again and banged my head, aware that the pulse and the hum had merged, had turned into a howl that seemed to be drilling a hole in my brain. The Buick had begun flashing like a neon sign, and a flood of green-backed beetles came tumbling out of the blazing trunk. They struck the floor, scuttered, died. The suction took hold yet again, and we started moving back toward the Buick. It was like being caught in a hideously strong undertow. Back and forth, back and forth.
Help me! I shouted in Ned's ear. You have to help me or we're going in!
What I was thinking by that time was that we were probably going in whether he helped me or not. He was blind but not deaf and had decided he wanted to live. He put his sneakered feet down on the cement floor and shoved backward just as hard as he could, his skidding heels splashing up little flurries of spilled gasoline. At the same time, Arky and Stephanie Colucci gave the rope another hard tug. We shot backward almost 5 feet toward the door, but then the undertow grabbed hold again. I was able to wrap a bite of slack rope around Ned's chest, binding him to me for better or worse. And then we were off again, the Buick taking back all the ground we'd gained and more. It moved us slowly, but with a terrible relentlessness. There was a breathless, claustrophobic pressure in my chest. Part of it was being wrapped in the rope. Part of it was the sense of being pinched and petted and jerked by a huge, invisible hand. I didn't want to go into the place I'd seen, but if we got much closer to the car, I would. We both would. The closer we got, the more the force pulling us stacked up. Soon it would snap the yellow nylon rope. The two of us would fly away, still bound together. Into that sick, purple throat we'd go, and into whatever lay beyond it.
Last chance! I screamed. Pull on three! One, two, three!
Arky and Stephanie, standing shoulder to shoulder just outside the door, gave it all they had. Ned and I pushed with our feet. We flew backward, this time all the way to the door before that force seized us yet again, pulling us as inexorably as a magnet pulls iron filings. I rolled over on my side.
Ned, the doorframe! Grab the doorframe!
He reached blindly out, extending his left arm fully. His hand groped.
To your right, kid, Steph screamed. You're right.
He found the door jamb and gripped. Behind us, there was another monstrous purple flash from the Buick, and I could feel the pull of the thing ratchet up another notch. It was like some hideous new gravity. The rope around my chest had turned into a steel band, and I couldn't get a single inch of fresh breath. I could feel my eyes bulging and my teeth throbbing in their gums. My guts felt all in a plug at the base of my throat. The pulse was filling up my brain, burning out conscious thought. I began slipping toward the Buick again, the heels of my shoes skidding on the cement. In another moment, I would be sliding, and a moment after that, I'd be flying like a bird sucked into a jet turbine engine. And when I went, the boy would go with me, likely with splinters of the door jamb sticking out from under his fingernails. He would have to come with me. My metaphor about chains had become literal reality.
Sandy, grab my hand!
I craned my neck to look and wasn't exactly surprised to see Huddy Royer, and behind him Eddie. They'd come back. It had taken them a little longer than it had taken Arky, but they'd come. And not because Steph had radioed them at Code D either. They'd been in their personals, and radio communications out of our barracks were foobar, for the time being anyway. No, they had just come. Huddy was kneeling in the doorway, holding on with one hand to keep from being sucked in. His hair didn't move around his head and his shirt didn't ripple, but he swayed back and forth like a man in a high wind just the same. Eddie was behind him, crouching, looking over Huddy's left shoulder, probably holding on to Huddy's belt, although I couldn't see that. Huddy's free hand was held out to me, and I seized it like a drowning man. I felt like a drowning man.
Now pull, goddammit,
Huddy growled at Arky and Eddie and Steph Colucci. The Buick's purple light was flashing in his eyes.
Pull your guts out!
They might not have gone quite that far, but they pulled hard and we tumbled out the door like a cork coming out of a bottle, landing in a pig pile with Huddy on the bottom. Ned was panting, his face turned sideways against my neck, the skin of his cheek and forehead burning against me like embers. I could feel the wetness of his tears.
Oh, Sarge Christ, get your elbow out of my nose!
Huddy yelled in a muffled, furious voice. Shut the door! Steph cried. Hurry before something bad gets out! There was nothing but a few harmless bugs with green backs, but she was right just the same, because the light was bad enough. That flashing, stuttery purple light. We were still tangled together on the pavement, arms pinned by knees, feet caught under torsos, Eddie now somehow tangled in the rope as well as Ned, yelling at Arky that it was around his neck, it was choking him, and Steph kneeling beside him trying to get her fingers under one of the bright yellow loops while Ned gasped and flailed against me. There was no one to shut the door, but it did slam shut, and I craned my head in an angle only raw panic would permit. Suddenly I was sure it was one of them. It had come through unseen, and now it was out, and maybe wanting a little payback for the one that had been slaughtered all those years ago. And I saw it, a shadow against the shed's white-painted side. Then it shifted, and the shadow's owner came forward, and I could see the curves of a woman's breast and hip in the dim light. Halfway home, and I get this feeling, Shirley said in an unsteady voice. This really bad feeling. I decided the cats could wait a little longer. Stop thrashing, Ned. You're making everything worse. Ned stilled at once. She bent down and with a single deft gesture freed Eddie from the loop around his neck. There you, baby, she said. And then her legs gave out. Shirley Pasternak sprawled on the hot tub and began to cry. We got Ned into the barracks and flushed his eyes in the kitchen. The skin around them was puffed and red, the whites badly bloodshot, but he said his vision was basically okay. When Huddy held up two fingers, that was what the kid reported. Ditto four. I'm sorry, he said in a thick, clogged voice. I don't know why I did that. I mean, I do. I meant to, but not now. Not tonight. Shh, Shirley said. She cut more water from the tap and bathed his eyes with it. Don't talk. But he wouldn't be stopped. I meant to go home, to think about it, just like I said. His swelled, horribly bloodshot eyes peered at me. Then they were gone as Shirley brought up another palm filled with warm water. Next thing I knew, I was back here again, and all I can remember thinking is, I've got to do it tonight. I've got to finish it once and for all. Then, except he didn't know what had happened then. The rest was all a blur to him. He didn't come right out and say that. Didn't need to. I didn't have to see it in his bloodshot, bewildered eyes. I had seen him, sitting behind the roadmaster's steering wheel with the gas can in his lap, looking pale and stoned and lost. It took hold of you, I said. It's always had some kind of pull. It's just never had anyone to use it on the way it could on you. When it called you, though, the rest of us heard too, in our own ways. In any case, it's not your fault, Ned. If there's fault, it's mine. He straightened up from the sink, groped, took hold of my forearms. His face was dripping and his hair was plastered to his forehead. The truth looked rather funny, like a slapstick baptism. Steph, who'd been watching the shed from the back door of the barracks, came over to us. It's dying down again already. I nodded. It missed its chance, maybe its last chance. To do mischief, Ned said. That's what it wanted. I heard it in my head. Or I don't know. Maybe I just made that part up. If you did, I said, then I did too. But there might have been more to tonight than just mischief.
Before I could say more, Huddy came out of the bathroom with the first aid kit. He set it down on the counter, opened it, and took out a jar of salve.
Put this all around your eyes, Ned. If it gets in them, don't worry. You won't hardly notice.
We stood there, watching him put the salve around his eyes in circles that gleamed under the kitchen fluorescence. When he was done, Shirley asked him if it was any better. He nodded.
Then come outside again, I said. There's one other thing I need to tell you. I would have earlier, but the truth is I never thought of it except in passing until I actually saw you sitting in that goddamn car. The shock must have kicked it loose.
Shirley looked at me with her brow furrowed. She'd never been a mother, but it was a mother's sternness I saw on her face right then.
Not tonight, she said. Can't you see this boy's had enough? One of you needs to take him home and make up some sort of story for his mother. She always believed Curtis's. I expect she'll believe one of yours if you can manage to stay together on the details. And then get him into bed.
I'm sorry, but I don't think this can wait, I said. She looked hard into my face and must have seen that I at least thought I was telling the truth, and so we all went back out to the smoker's bench, and as we watched the dying fireworks from the shed, the second show of the night, although there wasn't much to this one, at least not now, I told Ned one more story of the old days. I saw this one as you might see a scene from a play. Two characters on a mostly bare stage. Two characters beneath a single bright stage light. Two men sitting